and welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And isn't it the truth, my friends, that it doesn't matter whether or not we are rich or poor, or doctors or lawyers or Indian chiefs or gay or straight or trans, that all of us, we all go through so many ups and downs in our lives. And one of the things that I say to you every single week, and I hope that you really do take it all in, is that we do not need to navigate life's challenges on our own. And wouldn't it be a terrific thing if in the schools, you know, they teach the kids about exercise and about research and about math and science? Wouldn't it be a terrific thing if kids were really, really given the knowledge and were given permission that it was okay for them to ask for help if they were going through ups and downs in their own little lives? Because there's still such a stigma in this country and around the world about therapy and counseling and asking for help. And yet, life is really, really so very stressful these days around the world, around everywhere, with everything that's going on, with family issues, with the divorce rate being what it is. And for those of you who may not know, is that the divorce rate, as an example for first marriages, is 48%. And for second marriages, many, many people are surprised to hear, but the divorce rate for second marriages is 63%. And that number continues to rise, my friends, the more times that we marry. And the divorce rate for third marriages actually is 72%. So whether or not we're talking about divorce or domestic violence, I mean, if you're looking at the area of domestic violence, every single day, six women are murdered by their so-called intimate partners. And what about substance abuse? I mean, you know, if you are drinking too much or you're just taking too many pills of various kinds, prescription medications, over-the-counter medications. And so oftentimes, you know, my patients will tell me that they feel that they are just on a merry-go-round or a roller coaster ride, and not a fun merry-go-round ride. And yet there is still a lot of reluctance to reach out and ask for help. Or what about sex? We are not doing that well in the bedrooms here in the United States. You know, I cite a study. There was a study done at Pittsburgh Western Psychiatric Hospital, and this was a study. These were people who, at least on a conscious level, they were not in this study for their relationship issues. But there were 100 couples who defined their marriages as either happy or very happy, and you may be surprised to find out about what was going on or what was not going on in their bedrooms. 50% of these happy and very happily married women had difficulty becoming aroused. An additional 35% had difficulty with orgasm. 15% were unable to have orgasm under any circumstances at all. And what about the men? Well, the men, a third of the men had issues with premature ejaculation, which, by the way, is a very, very easy problem to resolve. And this number still actually surprises me. And what we found with the men was that 52% of men between the ages of 40 and 70 had some problems with erectile dysfunction. And, you know, so many men, they will go to their doctor. And of course, most doctors, they don't ever raise the question about sex. And I think men have to be very, very careful that it may not just be a remedy of taking a Viagra or a Cialis, but that there may be some cardiac issues. And of course, the real question, you know, then becomes is that, you know, what is it that's going on or not going on that is causing some blood flow issues to the penis? So whether or not you are seeking help for depression or anxiety or sexual issues or relationship issues, it's really, really important that you find yourself a really competent, thorough therapist who is not going to do a diagnosis in 10 or 15 minutes and who's going to write you a prescription for a variety of different kinds of pills without really getting to the root of the problem, really getting to know who you are, what your history is, what are your symptoms really all about. And that's why we have to be very, very careful whether or not we are seeking help in the area of finances or dentistry, that we truly, truly find ourselves in somebody's hands who's truly competent and knowledgeable and cares about us as human beings. Otherwise, the consumer can really, really be shortchanged very, very badly. And at worst, there can be a lot of harm that occurs from really inadequate and poor psychotherapy and psychiatry as well. Well, today I have a guest, my husband Jim and I. We were at a Passover Seder on Saturday night. It's still Passover. And Rabbis Leah and Perry Berkowitz, they were leading the Seder. And we happened to be sitting at a really interesting table. And of course, you know, people talk about, you know, what do they do? And I was seated next to a lovely woman, and across the table, there was a gentleman. And turns out the man, his name is Dr. Uriel Halbrach, and he is my guest today. And I really want to welcome you and thank you so much for being here.
Yes, it's my pleasure, Betty. And it was a good coincidence.
It was
that
we were sitting
at the same table.
It was. And we could spend probably the whole hour talking about your bio, but just so that the audience knows who you are and why I wanted you to come in today. Dr. Halbrach is the professor of psychiatry, the director of biobehavioral research, State University of New York at Buffalo SUNY. And you are also the founding chairman of the World Psychiatric Association, the section on interdisciplinary collaboration, which I'm going to ask you all kinds of questions about. And what was really interesting when I was going down this very lengthy, you said it was a brief bio, but it was a very lengthy bio, is that you were a combat physician, Golani Brigade at the IDF in Israel, and that must have been quite an experience. And you were also the vice chief medical officer of the Israeli Navy. 14 books. I barely finished writing one book and having it published. You've written 14 books.
Obviously, it's a very good book, even though it's only one.
It's a good book, but I mean, 14 books, that's really pretty amazing. You've written more than 350 papers in scientific journals and books and more than 670 abstracts. And it goes on and on. And of course, you are a research psychiatrist. And what you told me at the dinner is that you do not see individuals. You do not treat patients currently.
That's correct.
Did you ever?
For a very long time. And that was a very long experience. But now I'm focusing on research.
Why did you make the transition? After treating individuals, and I assume families and couples.
It's a long story, but it's an evolutional process. And out of curiosity, I was more and more interested in the research part of psychiatry or mental health, and started focusing more on the research aspect instead of individual patients.
And you've been doing that for many, many years, the research part.
Well, I'm doing research actually for almost 50 years now.
Wow, that's a long time.
And full-time, it's over 20 years.
So tell me, what is currently going on in the research in psychiatry, if we're looking at that? Let's start with trauma. Okay, what are the current studies and current research findings? And then we can compare how I deal with trauma with patients with PTSD or early child sexual abuse or a lot of traumas that people sustain, and what the current research findings are finding.
Well, that's a very intriguing question, and it's a very long answer if we really want to answer everything.
I want to hear.
However, my uncle once told me, if you cannot summarize everything that you know in one word, it means that you don't know it. So in one word, what's going on in mental health, it's a lot.
A lot.
A lot.
Well, let's hear what a lot is, because I am a critic of American mental health. I think that people are overly medicated. I think that people are shortchanged. As your wife and I were talking, she is also a therapist. You know, people are being expected to do diagnoses in 15 minutes and 20 minutes. And there's a lot of mishigas, and a lot of people are really being ripped off. The consumer is really being ripped off, especially if they really don't know what good psychotherapy and counseling really should be. So,
yeah, the issue is that, and this is what is fascinating about mental health in general and psychiatry in particular, is that the field is undergoing really a major significant change. And what was considered to be psychiatry just 20 or 30 years ago, it's now supposed to be old-fashioned. Because now psychiatry should be a comprehensive integration of biology, neuroscience, environmental issues, and personal psychological processes in the context of interrelationship.
Right.
As you mentioned in your foreword for this session, and it's not easy to comprehend all the multidimensional aspects of mental health and to integrate them into one story. And that's what some people don't realize. It's not only psychotherapy. Right. It's not only pharmacology, it's not only interrelational aspects, it's everything together. And it has also issues of economy.
Yes.
And politics.
And access.
And we see it a lot now, we see it a lot now in the United States. What is the impact of policy or politics determining policy on mental health of individuals. And we have to consider all of them when we are looking at well-being.
Absolutely. And you can't do it in a 15-minute session, and you can't do it in a half an hour session. And this integration is something that I rarely hear people actually talk about, whether we're talking about inflammation, whether we're talking about diet, whether we're talking about supplements and vitamins and exercise, and as you say, interpersonal relationships. I rarely hear people looking at the gestalt, and I know that they don't treat patients with that gestalt orientation.
First of all, it's not easy to be knowledgeable on all the aspects that go into this gestalt. Because in most medical schools or most residencies, they don't teach you.
Right.
The entire, what you call gestalt, or of we should probably talk about this multidimensional
right.
picture of
yes.
Mental health.
Exactly.
It's not easy. Just imagine that one person, the psychiatrist, should know medicine, biology, neurosciences, social sciences, politics, environmental sciences,
right,
and many other aspects. It's not easy to be an expert in all of them. It's not easy not only to be an expert, but to integrate all these aspects and to implement them to the particular patient. Now, if the system tells you we are paying you only $50 for this patient.
Correct.
Which also includes the paperwork.
Right.
And
right.
the time that is needed for the paperwork. You barely have time to evaluate the patient and to arrive at a decision.
Absolutely.
Which is not an easy task.
But this is
reality.
Well, this is reality, and this is the way so many organizations function. And, of course, you and I and your wife, we were discussing this at the Seder. So then what are we doing? I mean, if this is what corporate psychiatry and corporate mental health is really all about, I mean, our patients are really getting screwed. I mean, that's really the bottom line. I mean, when I did my training at McGill, and I thank God every day, I mean, I did my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill, it was an interdisciplinary approach. We did learn about integrating all of these different areas into assessment and into treatment. And, you know, when you say it's not easy, well, it may not be easy, but it's necessary. Otherwise, we're missing the boat. And our patients are really losing out.
Well, one way is to actually have a group effort. That means to have a group in which different members of the group have a different expertise.
Right.
Like psychologists, pharmacologists, social workers, and so on and so forth. And diagnostician. And then the role of the psychiatrist might be the integrator or the leader of this group. And the question is how you train, how you teach a person to be a leader of the group and not to be an individual practitioner. Like mm-hmm. most psychotherapists
right.
are.
Right, right.
And again, this is actually hope for the future. Mm-hmm. Because currently, most psychiatrists are not being trained to be leaders of integrative, collaborative groups.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It takes time and it takes money. It takes a paradigm shift in medical schools. And again, it's not easy. It's intriguing.
Well, what
and
is
nothing
ever
is easy?
Nothing, of
nothing
course.
Nothing is easy.
Right.
But almost everything is doable.
But around the world, I mean, you travel around the world. Are there countries, are there cities And I'm really curious, you know, about what's going on in Israel right now in our field, where they're doing it better than we are doing here in the United States.
That's an intriguing question. What is better? Better is when somebody says better, is they are doing more what I want to do.
Where it's, the treatment is more effective.
It depends on what. In Israel, many people have more experience with trauma.
Yes.
That's because of reality.
Of course.
Because in some areas of Israel, life is very stressful. Not in all areas. In the areas near the Gaza Strip border, for instance, and during recent years also near the Lebanese. So people, of course, in that areas have a lot of experience with trauma. And by having more experience, they are becoming more efficient with the treatment of people with trauma-related or stress-related disorders. However, they treat them according to their paradigms.
Yes, right.
And the paradigms are influenced by the United States paradigms. And then it's very interesting that somebody near the Gaza Strip is actually being treated many times as though or in the same conceptual way that a U.S., United States veteran from Vietnam War was treated many a long time ago, during and after the Vietnam War, when the situation is completely different.
Completely different, yes.
But that's reality that people, including psychiatrists, are following well-established paradigms and concepts.
And are reluctant to get out of their comfort zone regardless of whether or not the treatments are effective. I mean, and that's really the bottom line. You know, are the people getting better? You know, is there an improvement in relationships, in their depression, anxiety, their bipolar disorder? I mean, that's really the bottom line. Are we doing a better job?
We are doing a better job than we were doing 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. The issue is it good enough? Is it really, can it be better for the individual patient? And it always can be better, of course. There is no threshold of what is good or what is no good. It's really subjective.
No, for sure.
And we are better. We are better now. We have better medications. That's obvious. We have better integration or combination of medication with psychotherapy. The psychotherapy actions are getting better and more efficient. I don't know if we are going to agree on it, but when we talk about psychotherapy, it's not necessarily psychoanalytically oriented therapy.
Right.
It might be more behavioral, more behavioral cognitive changes. It might be more short-term therapy. There are different ways that the decision is actually what one or what combination of ways of the psychotherapy one should apply to the particular patient. And then it depends, of course, on the expertise of the therapist.
And on the insurance benefits. I mean, this
not
is,
everything
this is
covered
thing.
By insurance benefits, and that's that's reality.
Yeah.
We are not, and every practitioner is also a small businessman.
Exactly.
He has to make a living.
Yes.
And he has to comply with the financial system around him.
Do you find, though, that there are countries, I mean, maybe the Scandinavian countries, where they certainly care a lot more about people, about their citizens? In fact, my husband Jim was reading an article in the New York Times this morning where over 50% of people, and I forget what Scandinavian country, live alone, and what they're trying to do is to make sure that, not that the homes are being turned into hotels, but they understand the importance of socialization and relationships, so that they're trying to get people to build on relationships in all kinds of really innovative ways, so that loneliness is not going to become an epidemic like it is in the United States.
Well, there is a difference between, we cannot have a generalization about any society, and there is a difference between what we read in media or hear about and reality. I'll just give you one example. I had a very good friend, a biological psychiatrist actually, whom I knew from Israel, and then he was here in the United States for a while, and then he moved to Sweden, to the Karolinska Institute, which is a very prestigious research institute in neuroscience and in mental health. His main complaint was, not that it's cold, and it is cold.
It's cold.
But during the winter, it's dark.
Yes.
And when you live in darkness, you become also more depressed.
Right.
And you socialize less. And even when you drink, you tend to drink by yourself and not in a social event. So this was his perception. That in Scandinavia, it's terrible, it's depressing, it's dark, and people are very aloof. People don't socialize in the same way. And this was after he moved from the United States to Sweden. And he said that there is a big difference between a socialization in the United States, in New York, and in Stockholm, in Sweden.
So he found people more isolated?
People are more isolated. He found people more isolated there. Now, this was this person who was not Swedish. And when he arrived there, he was married to a Swede woman, and that's why he moved to Sweden. But he felt, and he was a stranger there, is on paper, the mental health system in Sweden is better than in the United States.
So we hear.
It covers more people. But you also pay more tax to cover all the social benefits.
But that was great. And as a Canadian, I have to tell you, you know, my mom, she lived till 98 and she paid
so
lots of
taxes. So you have very good genes.
I hope so. I hope so. And my parents, they paid a lot of taxes, but they didn't have to worry. They didn't have to worry about health care. They didn't have to worry about home care. They didn't have to worry about insurance benefits. I mean, everything was taken care of. And I think that that's a fabulous trade, to know that we're paying taxes.
Is it really fabulous trade? Because then you worry about your taxes.
but then you don't worry
and you about have a partner and you have a partner who gets much of your earning
but you don't
out
worry
of your pocket to sell, to have it spent on things that you have no control about
but you don't worry about health you don't worry about
but you worry about other things.
There are always, obviously, there's a lot of other things to worry about. But, I mean, I think that if you were to talk to most Canadians, that you'd probably find that we didn't care that we had to pay a lot of taxes because the benefits really outweighed the downside, certainly when it came to a single-payer healthcare system. I mean, it's wonderful.
Well, you can debate it. As I told you when we were chatting before the show now, I actually am a Buffalonian. This is not my accent. It's not a typical Buffalonian accent.
It's a great Israeli accent.
But I am a Buffalonian, and the Buffalo is near the Canadian border.
Yes.
And when I did accept patients, I got a lot of people who came from Canada.
Uh-huh.
And you might actually ask if the health system in Canada is so great and it's free, why should somebody cross the border to the United States to see an American physician, and they have there to pay because their government didn't pay for any treatment out of the country.
So you're not talking about you're not talking about just psychiatry. You're talking
I saw people who were seeking psychiatric treatment.
I'm surprised.
But they also came to other specialists in mm-hmm. Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
To get medical treatment. And the only thing that happened that was to their advantage, once there was a prescription, and an American prescription wouldn't be honored in Canada,
uh-huh.
I wrote a piece of paper with the prescription. They went to their family physician.
Mm-hmm.
In Toronto or in Hamilton or whatever, wherever they came from, he filled it up and then they went to the pharmacy with this with a Canadian prescription. But if mm-hmm. everything is so fine in Canada,
nothing's perfect.
They came to the United States for a evaluation and treatment.
But I would think that would probably be a small proportion of, you know, of people. I mean, I've been out of the country now for a number of years, but I mean out of Canada for a number of years, but you know, I still know and feel, I mean, that we in every respect it's a much kinder, gentler, equitable country where nothing is perfect, but people are not walking around, because I, you know, I still keep in touch with, you know, Canadian friends, are not as stressed, don't feel as crazy. The political climate is making us mishugana here, where it's much, people are living, I believe, a much better quality of life in many countries, including Canada, around the world, than we are here in the United States. But I want to ask you about current research in the area of depression. What's happening?
Again, a lot.
A lot, okay. I'm all ears.
And there is a lot of and very fast progress. First of all, we learn more and more about the underpinnings of depression.
Mm-hmm.
First, there is no one depression. There are different mm-hmm. kinds of depressions mm-hmm. and different path towards depression or towards making somebody sad or depressed. There are also different kinds of depression,
mm-hmm.
of different symptoms of depression, and many people have different kind of symptoms. And
right.
the treatment many times, or should be, according to their individual symptoms. And we are learning more and more recently about even genetic predisposition to response to specific drugs. And we are learning more who is going to respond to a particular medication and how they are going to respond to it. We are learning more and more on the connectivity of systems in the brain that might be involved in depression or in different kinds of depression. We are learning more on the molecular aspects of depression. We start learning more about the interrelationship between the brain and the environment. And what is, why somebody is more sensitive or more vulnerable to depression or to develop symptoms, and that has to do with the trauma.
Right.
If there are 100 people who have exactly the same trauma, only maybe about 10%, 10 out of these 100, will develop a post-traumatic stress disorder or any other symptoms. The 90 others would not. So who are these 10%?
What's it about?
Who are vulnerable? Who are the people who actually become stronger in response to trauma? In the same way, when we talk about trauma, if we take the concentration camps, who are the people like Frankel or Elie Wiesel?
Yes.
Who actually became stronger. Not only that they were not survivors, they became stronger. And it actually provoked them for their time, for their life after the concentration camp, to be really very productive and very innovative.
Yes.
And to restructure their personas, their whole person after the concentration camp, while others were really broken.
You know, I guess I would wonder, it'd be so interesting, and I'm sure that there have been books written about this, to take a look at, for example, Frankel's and Elie Wiesel's family of origin, and what happened and what didn't happen to them growing up as children prior to their, you know, being in concentration camps, and to see whether or not there was something about those early years that helped build a certain kind of resilience that perhaps some of the other people weren't fortunate enough to have when they were growing up. It would be so amazing to find out what were the differences. Where did Elie Wiesel's and Viktor Frankl's, where did that resilience come from? Did it come from the situation that they were in, that somehow they were able to do something to keep going where so many other people were not able to? What was it, the early years that had an impact? Was it something that went on in the camps? I mean, I'm sure there have been things that have been written about this, right?
Right. Actually, you put your finger on the top of the issue here.
Oh, good. What
actually,
is that?
Actually, your mouth, not only on the microphone, but on the on the topic.
Good.
The issue is, what is resilience and what is vulnerability? Yeah. And when does it start? There are quite a number of studies for actually for the last 40 or 50 years. They are not new, but they are becoming more and more and more and more elaborate about the development of vulnerability and development of resilience. starting from very early age.
Yes.
Actually, when we talk about very early age, this is even during pregnancy of the mother.
Interesting.
Because what British epidemiologist found a long time ago, his name was Barker, and this is called the Barker hypothesis, he actually was studying cardiovascular disorders. And what he found out that in the Netherlands, in Holland, there was more cardiovascular disorder, that means heart disorders and vessel, blood vessels disorders, and then also diabetes and other what is called metabolic syndrome in people who were whose mothers were pregnant with them in 1944, which was the great famine in Holland. Because what happened is that when the Germans knew that they are going to lose the war, they didn't sell, they cut food supplies to the civilian population in Holland.
Which affected the fetuses.
And the women who were pregnant there were under a lot of stress, not only the war, but also they didn't have food.
Right.
And this influenced their babies.
Of course. Of course.
And then, so this guy, Barker, developed the Barker hypothesis that stress for a pregnant mother may influence her children, and the disease might appear even 30, 40, or 50 years later.
It makes sense.
But they make them more vulnerable. And now what people started finding out during the last 10 to 20 years is that actually the time of the trauma to the mother can influence what kind of disorder the baby will have. And for instance, in a it depends on what is being developed in this time of trauma to the mother. So if it the part of the brain, for instance, that influences or is involved in schizophrenia at that time is developed, the person eventually will be more vulnerable to schizophrenia. At some other time, the person or the baby will be more vulnerable to depression. It means that if you want actually to prevent schizophrenia or depression and several other aspects of disorders, the time for prevention is during the mother's pregnancy.
Which makes complete sense. I mean, and I think that we're...
The issue is how to do it.
Well, don't you think, though, that there's a lot more focus these days on pregnancy and de-stressing and yoga and meditation and exercise and to try to make sure that your relationships and, you know, your work are as, you know, is in a as best a place as possible to not cause trauma to the mother or the fetus? I think that we're hearing a lot more about this.
Well, it's important to have a happy pregnant mother.
Yes.
That's the bottom line. However, it's very important to have also a relaxed father.
Yes.
Even before the pregnancy. A relaxed father is very important. There was an Israeli study a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, in which they actually found out that combat pilots in the Israeli Air Force have more girls than boys.
And why did they? Why?
The issue is why. The explanation is they're under a lot of stress.
Of course.
And the chromosome, the Y chromosome of the chromosome that determines
the sex,
the male or the boy baby, is not as strong as the chromosome, the X chromosome that determines the girl baby. So from birth, you might say that women actually are, or girls are stronger.
Okay.
So if the father is under a lot of stress, his sperms, which carry the Y chromosome or the male chromosome, are not as competitive as the female chromosomes or the sperms with the female chromosomes. So eventually, they have more girls.
Interesting. Well, you know, one of the things that, you know...
So this even
before the child
conception.
Born, and before the conception.
Even before the conception.
Well, I mean, we know a lot about... I mean, I think this is really interesting about, you know, before the conception. But there are so many things that people can actually do to improve the quality of their lives and relationships and distress. I mean, beginning with, you know, plant-based diets. I mean, we know that people in Sardinia, as an example, they live the longest. They interact, they nap, they have plant-based diets. We know that vitamins and supplements are important. We know the benefits of exercise. We know the benefits of meditation and dancing and positive visualization. There are just so many things that we know based on evidence-based research, and yet it's so interesting. And Gary Null, who is the founder of the Progressive Radio Network, you know, he coined this phrase, which I love, intentional ignorance and intentional neglect. So that there are a lot of positive things that have come out of research studies.
So what is intentional neglect?
We self-sabotage. We are self-destructive. We know the importance of exercise. Hundreds, thousands of studies have been written about exercise. We know the importance of having a plant-based diet and getting rid of the sugars and the meats and all the chazarai that really gets in the way of our physical health. And yet people, we make a lot of excuses and we self-sabotage and we engage in a lot of destructive and self-destructive behaviors, which impacts our relationships, which impacts our physical health, and which impacts the quality of our life. And I think that this is where, you know, people, I think, beginning in the, you know, if not in the family, certainly in the school, need to be continually motivated and educated to do what is in their best interest.
So how can you get them motivated?
You know, when I lived in Canada, after my postgraduate work, within 3 years, I ran with two other women, the entire school social services program for the English schools in Greater Montreal. And we had a lot of freedom because we didn't worry about money and budgets. We were able to design and implement programs where we were able to teach kids at the kindergarten level, not only to how to deal with emotions, but to be able to motivate them to behave in ways that were in their best interest. I mean, for me, I think that education, and I talk a lot about relationship education, but I think education is key. People have to be educated to know what, in fact, is in their best interest, whether or not it's you know, getting good psychotherapy, whether or not it's having good diets, whether or not it is eliminating toxic people and toxins, actual chemical toxins from their lives. And yet, you know, Gary Null, he's a world alternative health expert, written a million books as well. And you know, we oftentimes, you know, we'll talk about how for a variety of reasons, people continue to self-destruct in all kinds of ways. And to get people to be motivated, I mean, that's, you know, that's part of what I try to do with patients and, you know, what you do. It's challenging. But we do know a lot about what works. And yet it's hard for, I think, probably the majority of people to really stay on that path, on that constructive path, relationship-wise, health-wise. I mean, do you agree?
Absolutely, yes, because I think that's one of the problems, which is inertia.
Yes, laziness.
And I don't know if it's laziness. Sometimes it takes some efforts to continue the inertia.
Yeah, it does.
Especially emotional effort. But from the other side, it's not easy to get into a mode of change.
Right.
People don't want change.
Exactly. Unless there is a crisis. I mean, I joke all the time. Nobody ever, ever calls me and says, I need help with communication or problem-solving skills. That never happens. There's been a suicide attempt. There's been suicidal ideation. There's been, you know, everything has fallen apart. And then maybe then that will be the precipitant for somebody to reach out and say, hey, I think I maybe should call somebody and get some help. And I think that we still have to do a much better job in making it okay for people to ask for help when life is in shambles.
But then what would be the help? Let's say that they ask for help. So what help can you give them?
Well, after, you know, ruling out physical problems, which, you know, I mean, I was looking at some studies about, you know, looking at symptoms of depression and things that look like clinical depression, but that aren't, you know, for example, you know, people may have low levels of vitamin D. They may be dehydrated. They may have thyroid issues. They maybe aren't sleeping. So that there are a lot of different things, you know, looking at things in a very systemic way that we have to be able and willing to look at to figure out what is it that's really going on. And then once people have really hit rock bottom, I mean, I have found, and I've been practicing now for a very long time, that that's the only time when there is any real motivation to maybe get to the root of the problem and start to deal so that they can improve the quality of their lives and the quality of their relationships. And so it's complicated. As you say, it's not easy. But what in life is easy if we're going to excel in anything?
So how can you make it easier if it's not easy?
I do this show every week and have been in national radio and TV for a very long time, trying to motivate people to ask for help when things start to go amiss. And I always say, you know, every week, I hope that there's some little thing. I mean, even in our conversation, that there's some little thing that somebody will have heard today where they'll have this aha moment, and maybe they'll reach out and you know, reach out to a therapist or to a psychiatrist. Or maybe they'll go and they'll have a physical and they'll realize that their depression may have to do with something that's off physicality-wise. Something to motivate people to take better care of themselves physically and emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically.
Yeah, that's an important point that you raised here, because depression or a feeling of being sad can be a result of many, many physical disorders.
Exactly.
First of all, it might be a side effect of many medications.
Right, exactly.
It might be associated with hypothyroidism,
right.
with diabetes, with hypertension.
Right.
And with many, many physical abnormalities.
Which have to be ruled out.
And that's why you need a physician to diagnose
the disorder. It's way too easy to write a prescription of Zoloft and Prozac. Leave! Or to write a prescription for Viagra or Cialis. You know something, Dr. Halbrecht, listen, I just got this motion from my producer here. Do you realize that we've been talking for almost an hour, that there is about 60 seconds left, and we could be talking about all of these things for the next year, right? You'll have to come back.
It depends how talkative you are. It might be for 10 years.
It may be for 10 years. But listen, I really want to thank you for coming in. And there's so much more. There's so many things that I really wanted to talk with you about, with your work, with your research. But the conversation definitely needs to continue. And no, really, thank you for your insight into, you know, this conversation. And I hope that people have heard, you know, some of the things that you've had to say and some of the things that we've been discussing, and that that maybe it'll make a difference to, even if it was just one person, you know, thousands of people that are listening to the show, you know, hopefully we'll have had some positive impact today.